Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 231. And it is September 24th. Turn the microphone down just a little bit. Okay, you see the schedule on the screen on the right-hand side? So indeed, today is the 24th, so there are lab practicums this week. This morning at 7:30 there was a lab practicum, then at 12:30 there's going to be another practicum, then Wednesday's labs will get a practicum. And we're going to carry on with lecture starting with axial skeleton, then on Wednesday talk about appendicular skeleton. And let's see, your exam one scores are graded and in Blackboard, but I noticed that there is an error on the answer key for exam A. So if you remember, if you took exam A, then maybe you have two or three, maybe four, maybe five additional points. I'm not really sure. Okay, so I got to check that and then regrade the tests. But you'll be able to see them in lab anyway. Okay? All right, so that's the schedule. Your next exam is on October 15th. That's the eighth week. So you had the first test on the fourth week, the next one on the eighth week, except that exam is not going to be on Wednesday. It's going to be on a Monday, right after the weekend. All right, and there's also a lab practicum that day, practicum number two on October 15th. So it's a little ways down the road, but I'm sure it's going to happen pretty fast. Oh, wait a second, I'm not sure why I have, this and this don't belong right here. Lab practicum two don't occur on the 3rd and 8th of October. All right, that's a little bit of a misprint. All right, so any questions? So don't forget, in Blackboard, the score that's in Blackboard is your exam score, the percentage multiplied by 2. All right, because every test is worth 200 points. And so if you want to figure out your percentage, divide your score in Blackboard by 2, and then it's just a straight 90, 80, 70, 60 scale after that. Okay? All right, so axial skeleton. Here we see a picture of the skeleton. We're going off the screen just a little bit, but I think I should be able to work with that. All right, so you see two different colors of bones on the skeleton right here because you can classify all the bones in the body as belonging to one of these two divisions. And these two divisions are the, what is this right here that I'm circling? Axial skeleton, which includes the skull, the vertebral column, the rib cage, and the sternum. Right, that's the axial skeleton, and then all the rest of the bones make up the appendicular skeleton, and we're going to look at appendicular skeleton next time. So today we're going to talk about the skull and continue on with a little bit of an introduction of bones, vertebral column, and ribs. All right, so let's look at the slide on the left-hand side. Here are some landmarks of bones. So this is just nomenclature that you should know. We talked about some of this stuff already in lab. And a raised rough spot on a bone is always used for muscle attachment. So a muscle to bone connection is going to be a tendon or a ligament attachment. And a ligament is just a bone to bone connection. And that dense regular connective tissue is going to be pulling on that bone all the time. And bone is a lot like a muscle. What kind of tissue is muscle? Is a living tissue. It's made out of living cells. They have a nucleus. And don't forget, bone is a living tissue as well. It has cells. What's the name of the cell that we find in bone? Osteocytes, right? And when you exercise a bone, it gets bigger and stronger as well, just like a muscle does. So when a tendon or a ligament attaches to a bone, that area that of attachment is going to hypertrophy. It's going to grow and get bigger and stronger as a result. All right, so one of these things is what we call a process. A process is a raised rough spot on a bone used for what kind of function? Muscle attachment. Tubercle is another name. Some smaller processes are called tubercles or tuberosities. Trochanters, epicondyles, malleolus. These are all special names for a process in one or maybe two locations in the body, but there's still going to be a process. And a crest is a process, but it's going to be long and narrow. And the same thing for a line. A line is a process, but it's not going to be very tall, but it's going to be for attachment for a muscle. And a spine is going to be long and narrow, but much more prominent. So it's going to be sticking far away from the surface of the bone. All right, a depression or a bowl for holding something. I just felt the rubber band snap. Let me see what's going on with the recorder right here. I can't even get it off. Okay, hopefully the recorder's working. It's a bowl for holding something, and typically we call that a fossa. And if it's an elongated fossa, we call that a sulcus, or maybe we're going to call it a groove. We can look at some sulcus today, on a rib. Sometimes we can call it a groove, and an alveolus is just a pocket. Maybe it's a little bit deeper. Okay, and don't forget, okay, then a depression we could also call a meatus, like the internal acoustic meatus. I have that down over here, a hole or a passageway, but a meatus doesn't go all the way through a bone like a foramen does. All right, so a depression is for holding something. A meatus is a passageway for sound, for instance, entering the temporal bone, and a foramen is a passageway where something can go all the way through a bone, like an artery or a vein or nerve or maybe all three. A canal is a foramen, but a long one. So it might even worm its way through a bone, might make some turns and curves inside the bone. A fissure is a foramen that's really long and narrow on the surface of the bone. And a sinus is a cavity inside of a bone. Like the paranasal sinuses are cavities. And the medullary cavity is the deep inside of a long bone that contains bone marrow. Then we have smooth surfaces. So processes are rough surfaces, but here are some smooth surfaces, and smooth surfaces are for joints. A condyle, typically, is what is used for a joint. So if you palpate it with your fingertip, it's going to be nice and smooth. On the proximal epiphysis of some bones, we have the head, and that's going to be nice and smooth. That's for articulation as well. A facet has a condylar surface. It's smooth, and it's going to be a depression. It's going to hold the head of another bone, right, to form a joint. And then we've got a couple special articulating surfaces here called the trochlea and capitulum, and we're going to find these on the humerus, on the distal epiphysis of the humerus, and we want to be able to identify the trochlea and capitulum. We're going to do that on Wednesday. One other last landmark that's pretty important is a ramus of a bone. Ramus is a part of a bone that makes a 90-degree bend to the body of the bone, or the major part of the bone. So I see the mandible right here. This is the body of the mandible. And when it makes that 90-degree turn to go up to the TMJ, that's called the mandibular ramus. We're going to see a couple of rami in this class. Okay, so axial skeleton versus the appendicular skeleton. We got bones that make up the skull in the axial skeleton. We got a hyoid bone. We got 26 bones that make up the vertebral column and 25 bones that make up the thoracic cage. And I'm never going to test you on how many bones there are in the different divisions right here, but that's just for your own information, your own purposes. Okay, next time we're going to talk about appendicular skeleton, but not today. All right, we're just going to focus on axial skeleton. All right, so if we look at the skull, which is the first part of the axial skeleton, the skull could be broken down into two categories of bones as well. Bones that are facial bones that make up the face versus cranial bones. These are bones that make up the cranial vault that protect the brain. All right, so you got to make sure you know all of these different bones. And, of course, starting today, for those of you that had a practicum, you got to know what frontal, parietal, occipital, temporal bone as being cranial bones, as well as the sphenoid. And some other bones that are more medial, like the ethmoid bone is a cranial bone. Can't see it very well on this diagram. The rest of the bones are facial bones, like the mandible. What's the upper jaw bone called? Maxilla. And then the cheekbone is the zygomatic, right? And then here's the lacrimal bone and nasal bone, and then the vomer is a facial bone as well, and I can't really see much of the vomer on this orientation. This edge right here, these sockets are what we call alveoli, so this is the alveolar margin, and then here's a process sticking up between two alveoli. That's the alveolar process, and we can see that on the mandible as well as the maxilla. Okay, so a wormian bone, I don't see on this diagram right here, is a variable bone within a suture someplace. Some people might have them and some people might not. All right, so make sure you know which bones are cranial bones, which ones are facial bones. And then there are going to be three bones inside the temporal bone, in particular the petrous region of the temporal bone, and these are important for hearing. They're the malleus, incus, and stapes, and I could have all three between my fingertips right here, and you couldn't say that I don't have them between my fingertips because they're that small. Okay, in lab we'll get to take a look at them. Nasal conchae inside the nasal cavity. These are bones that air condition the air and clean the air as we breathe in. And one hyoid bone, which you can't see in this diagram, but it's a horseshoe-shaped bone that fits up inside the mandible, and it's a floating bone. Right? It just floats inside the mandible, attached by some muscles. Okay, the cavities. The cranial cavity, formed by the cranial bones. The nasal cavity, formed by these facial bones. You should know which bones make up the nasal cavity. It's part of the pre-lecture reading assignment. And then there are four bones that contain paranasal sinuses. The frontal, the sphenoid, ethmoid, about in this region right here, and the maxilla, filled with lymphatic tissue. All right, so that's kind of just an overview of the skull. Let's take a look at a good exam figure right here. All right, on the right-hand slide, you can see all the bones that we were just talking about, plus all the associated structures, like the styloid process on the mandible. What's the function of the styloid process? Muscle attachment, you're just all automatically going to say. And then a big, massive process here called the mastoid process, kind of down deep to your earlobe. Okay, what's the function of the mastoid process? A muscle attachment, right. Which one has stronger muscles attached to it, the mastoid process or styloid process? Mastoid, because it's bigger, more massive. All right, also within the temporal bone, here's the squamous region of the temporal bone. Here is the external acoustic meatus. You could call that the auditory meatus. That allows sound energy to enter the petrous region of the temporal bone. Okay, and then here's a process that's going forward, reaching out and touching the zygomatic bone. These two processes form the zygomatic arch. And be aware how we name processes. We name a process not after the bone that it is on, but after the bone that it articulates with. So here is the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. Here is the temporal process of the zygomatic bone. So that's just some nomenclature. The upper jawbone is called the maxilla. I guess the microphone went out, huh? The maxilla. And here's a process coming superiorly off the maxilla, and it's reaching up and touching the frontal bone. So how would we name this process right here? Yeah, that's the frontal process of the maxilla. Okay. Oh, what color is that light? Red. I could have guessed. Okay. That's on the transmitter. Maybe I'll get some new batteries for it. All right, this hole right here, this depression holds an eyeball. Sometimes we call that an orbit. So this is an orbit that holds the eyeball. Here is an orbital plate of the frontal bone. Here's the orbital plate of the zygomatic bone. And there is an orbital plate on the sphenoid as well as the ethmoid. Let me get some batteries out. All right, the joints in the skull, most of them are immovable, and we call those sutures. And so you got to know the names of the sutures. For instance, the squamous suture right here, because it's on what part of the temporal bone? Yeah, it's on the squamous part of the temporal bone. Well, I can't even turn it off. Okay, but I can pull the batteries out. Okay, and you should know where these sutures exist. So this squamous suture is between what bones? The temporal and the parietal. So this was a lab quiz, or will be a lab quiz for a lot of people. So a lot of times maybe it is helpful to actually draw this out on a blank piece of paper. Hold your ears. I'm going to turn the transmitter back on. Let's see what happens. Hopefully it just turns on nice and in a nice controlled fashion. Oh, good. Okay. All right, so these processes you have to know, all the sutures you have to know. The sagittal suture you can't quite see on this illustration, but you can see the coronal, you can see the lambdoidal, occipital mastoid suture, and these are all immovable joints. There is only one joint in the skull that does move, and that's the TMJ. TMJ stands for temporomandibular joint. That's a joint between the mandible and the mandibular fossa, right here in the temporal bone. Okay, coronoid process is for muscle attachment. What else do I want to say? Oh, some foramina. Don't forget, a foramen is a passageway in a bone. So here's the mental foramen, because this is the mental region of the mandible. Infraorbital foramen, supraorbital foramen. Sometimes it's just a notch in the rim of the superior margin of the orbit. Okay. And the sockets that the root of teeth fit into, what do we call those things? Alveoli. So I can see an alveolus right here and right here. Okay, but they're deep inside the bone. Okay. So, here is a wormian bone. Sometimes we call that a sutural bone. Sutural and wormian bone are exactly the same thing. All right, so here we can see the sphenoid bone going all the way across from one side of the skull to the other, including these orbital plates right here, which make the inferior part of the orbit. See nice nasal bones. You can see the nasal conchae inside the nasal cavities. And you can see the nasal septum. And how many different colors of this nasal septum do you see? Yeah, there's two. So the superior bone is the ethmoid. The inferior is the vomer. And the ethmoid has two nasal conchae, including the middle and the superior that we can't see on this diagram. And then the inferior nasal concha is a bone all by itself. And we talked a lot about these bones in lab. Anybody have a question over the skull, these skull bones? And these sutures and joints, TMJ versus sutures? Okay. The only thing that I didn't show you so far were the paranasal sinuses. But you have a pretty decent picture of paranasal sinuses. Someplace in this chapter. Right here. All right, so the four bones that have paranasal sinuses, the maxillary sinus, the frontal sinus, the ethmoid sinuses, and the sphenoidal sinuses, here and here. So those you have to know. All right, so that's it for the skull, the vertebral column. All right, let's look at vertebral column. Oh, but also don't forget about the hyoid bone, right in here. It's a floating bone. Okay, so here we have the vertebral column. And you can see that there are five different divisions of vertebrae. These vertebrae are stacked on top of each other. Sometimes they're individual bones. Sometimes they're fused together, depending on what division they're in. The most superior division is called the cervical region. And these are vertebrae that you find in your neck. Those are all cervical vertebrae, and you have seven of them, and they're named from superior to inferiorly, 1 through 7. The next division is the thoracic division. There are 12 thoracic vertebrae, typically in people, starting with number 1 going all the way down to 12. And so this would be the first thoracic vertebrae, but in short, we would just say that's T1. Here's T2, T3. We don't have different names for these vertebrae, except for C1 and C2. They do have special names because they have a special function, and they have a special structure, as you can imagine. Okay, the next division below thoracic is lumbar, and there are 5 of them. Below that is the sacral, and there are 5 sacral vertebrae. These are all fused together to help form a pelvis, and then below that are the coccygeal vertebrae. And the sacral vertebrae, we just abbreviate S. C stands for cervical. T stands for thoracic. The coccygeal, we don't want to say C because that stands for cervical vertebrae. So we usually abbreviate that CO, capital C, little O for coccygeal. Okay. And the sacral region, there's a lot of variability. There's typically 5, but you might have 1 more or 1 less. And there's even more variability in the coccygeal vertebrae. You might have 3, you might have 5, but typically it's about 4. The thoracic region, there's some variability in that as well. There might be somebody in here with 11 thoracic vertebrae, but most of us probably have 12. All right, I've never seen anybody with not an exact number of 7 cervical vertebrae or exactly 5 thoracic vertebrae, but I wouldn't be surprised if somebody has a little bit of variation in their vertebral column. Okay, so you got how many cervical? And how many thoracic? And how many lumbar? Five. And you got to know that. It's pretty easy to remember if you think of when do you typically have breakfast? At 7. And when do you have lunch? At noon. And when do you have supper? At 5. Right? Even though you never have meals at those particular times, you just have to agree with me because it will make memorizing those numbers and those divisions really, really easy. Okay. We have some curvatures of the spine. Okay. We see there are, some of these are normal, the cervical and lumbar arch anteriorly. So here's a cervical vertebrae, and you can see them arching anteriorly, and the lumbar arching anteriorly. And the cervical is anterior because your head should be held over the common mass of your body, so it's easier to hold your head up. Okay, if it was positioned way posterior, then you'd have to be leaning forward all the time to hold your head up. The thoracic and sacral curvature is posterior. And that's because in these regions of your body, right, you have important organs that are taking up space. And so the thoracic region curves posteriorly to allow for extra space for lungs and the heart in the thorax. And there's a sacral curvature to allow for reproductive organs, like uterus, for instance, and the urinary bladder. Right? The cervical and lumbar curvatures are there to help compensate for these posterior curvatures of the thoracic and sacral regions. Okay. So those are normal curvatures. You have some abnormal curvatures. A kyphosis is an exaggerated thoracic curvature. Right in this region right here, sometimes we call that a humpback. A lordosis in this region, an anterior exaggerated anterior curvature right here, we'd call that a swayback. And scoliosis would be a lateral curvature of the vertebral column. I don't have a picture of the lateral curvature, but there is a lateral curvature which is normal, which I can't quite see on this diagram, but here is an anterior view. So this is the left side, this is the right side of the vertebral column. Normally we would see a little bit of a bulge right here, curvature over to the right side in the vertebral column. And who could maybe explain that? Why would we see a little curvature, a little bulge, a lateral bulge right about in this region of the vertebral column? Yeah, because your heart is right there, and that's going to cause a little bit of a deviation of the thoracic vertebral column. All right, so that's a lot about vertebrae. Let's look at one part of the I might as well go back and talk about it right now. So you have 12 thoracic vertebrae, and we know these are thoracic vertebrae because by definition they have to have a rib attached to them. If there's a rib attached to a vertebrae, it has to be a thoracic vertebrae. So in this individual, and indeed most individuals, they have 12 thoracic vertebrae. How many pairs of ribs would that normal individual have? They're going to have exactly 12 pairs of ribs because this individual has 12 thoracic vertebrae. If an individual had 11 thoracic vertebrae, how many pairs of ribs would they have? They would have 11. Okay, so there's got to be a one-to-one correspondence. Is there ever a rib attached to a lumbar vertebrae? No, by definition not. What about a cervical vertebrae? Never have a rib attached to a cervical vertebrae. If there is a rib attached to a vertebrae, what kind of rib is it going to be? It's got to be a thoracic vertebrae, pretty much by definition. Okay, so here is a nice cutaway view of the vertebral column. And here is the body of a vertebrae. This is the massive, most strongest part of a vertebrae. This is what holds up weight. So I see a vertebral body here, here, and here. And I can see medullary bone filled with bone marrow. And in us, it's probably already converted into yellow bone marrow. There's going to be fat in these spaces. And in between the vertebrae is some fibrous cartilage. This is what we call an intervertebral disc between the vertebrae. And discs have two components to them. There is the annulus fibrosus, which is a ring on the exterior that's a superficial surface of a vertebral disc which is tough fibrous cartilage. And then the inner part is called the nucleus pulposus. And this does not contain fibrous cartilage. Okay, it's hyaline cartilage and some fluid right in this region. And if the annulus fibrosus is damaged, then the nucleus pulposus can actually squirt out from that intervertebral space and cause problems, especially if it bulges into this foramen right here that we call the intervertebral foramen. It's an intervertebral foramen because it occurs between vertebrae. If we just look at a single vertebrae, we don't see this hole, but if we put a couple of vertebrae together, we see this foramen for the exiting and entrance of various nerves to and from the spinal cord. All right, but I wanted to show you this intervertebral disc. And let's look at, here we see a bulging disc right here into the spinal nerve, impinging upon this nerve, and then this nerve can become damaged and it won't transmit information properly. If it's impinging upon a sensory nerve, then you'll have pain in some part of the body where this nerve is coming from. Or if it's impinging on a motor division of this nerve, then you might actually lose some motor control, some function in your body. Right? So you might feel pain in your big toe, not because your big toe is being damaged, but because the nerve that's coming from your big toe is being damaged as it enters the spinal cord. And you can see the bulge of the nucleus pulposus, because the annulus fibrosus has been herniated. And here we can see a nice MRI of a herniated disc. All right, so here's a typical vertebrae. You should be able to draw this out on a blank piece of paper. So let's go over some of the parts of a vertebrae. This is the vertebral body. This is the massive part of a vertebrae. There's some bony plates that extend posteriorly. And we're going to call this the pedicle. So here's a pedicle of a vertebrae. Oh, here's that circle is a pedicle. Then there's another bony plate that proceeds even a little bit more posteriorly. This is the lamina. So you have two pedicles, one here, two lamina that come together to form the vertebral arch, which is the bony armor plating laterally and posteriorly around the spinal cord. The bony plate that protects the spinal cord anteriorly is the vertebral body. Then we have some processes. Sticking off laterally are the transverse processes. What's the function of this transverse process right here? Muscle attachment. That's right. A lot of muscles attached to it that stabilize the vertebral column. Here is the spinous process, which protrudes straight posteriorly. Those are all the little bumps that you can feel on the median plane of your back, spinous process, and again, that's for muscle attachment. We see a couple smooth surfaces on this vertebrae right here. Here is an articular facet for a tubercle on a rib, okay, and here is a demifacet for the head of a rib. So you could actually probably tell me what kind of vertebrae this is. If there's a rib that attaches right here, it's got to be a thoracic vertebrae, right? There's some other articulating surfaces. Here's a superior articulating facet and surface for articulating with the vertebrae that's superior to this one. And if we were to turn this one over, we would see the inferior articulating process and facet for articulating with the vertebrae below it. And this hole right here is the hole for vertebrae, for the spinal cord to go through the vertebrae. And if we take a bunch of vertebrae and line them all up together, that becomes the vertebral canal. Okay, the first two vertebrae, C1 and C2, have special names. And their special names for number one is the Atlas. And it was named after that mythological figure, mythological god that's holding up the world, and his name was Atlas. All right, so C1 is holding up the head, that's why it's called the atlas, and the joint between C1 and the occipital bone, remember the condylar surfaces on the occipital bone, allow for a certain kind of motion, and the motion typically is what we call a yes motion, which is flexion and extension of the head. Okay, that's the only motion that's allowed between occipital bone and C1. But you can look to the left, you can look to the right, that's a rotation. It doesn't happen between atlas and the occipital bone, but it is allowed between C1 and C2, and C2 is what we call the axis. So here is C2. You might notice that the C1 does not have a vertebral body. It has migrated and fused to the vertebral body of C2. So I see it sticking up right over here. We call that the dens. Let's look at the next picture. Here is the dens on C2. That's the body of C1, but it's not really attached to C1. This is the axis around which the C1 can rotate around C2. So the joint between C1 and C2 allows for rotation, but not flexion and extension. If somebody's head is hit really hard and this joint is flexed or extended, then the dens has a tendency to break off and then migrate right into the spinal cord, and usually that's immediately fatal when that happens. So the joint between C1 and C2 is what we call the no motion, right? It's just a lateral rotation, right lateral, left lateral rotation. But between C1 and the occipital bone, that's for an extension and flexion, but no rotation. If that does rotate, okay, by accident, maybe due to some kind of trauma, then that usually causes a fracture of C1. Fortunately, that can be a stable fracture in many circumstances, and not causing any permanent injury to somebody as long as they're transported to the hospital properly, right? And those bone fragments don't enter the spinal cord. And here is the transverse ligament of the atlas that holds the dens in the approximate position up against C1 right here. The other thing that we notice about cervical vertebrae are these spinous processes are bifurcated. They have two points. That's going to be a nice indication, a nice distinguishing feature that cervical vertebrae have compared to all other vertebrae, like thoracic and lumbar vertebrae, do not have a bifid spinous process. The other thing about cervical vertebrae that you're going to notice is that cervical vertebrae, not only do they have the vertebral foramen, but they have additional foramina in the transverse processes that we call the transverse foramina. This is for a blood vessel to go from the aorta up to the brain, and it's going to be called the vertebral artery. So these are two arteries of only four that bring blood to the brain. And we only find these on cervical vertebrae. If we look at a thoracic vertebrae, okay, I can see that it has a facet right here for articulating with a rib. And there's going to be a demifacet here and a demifacet over here. So there's half of a facet here and half of a facet here for articulating with the rib. And what kind of vertebrae has a rib attached to it? Only a thoracic vertebrae. So you don't see these articulating surfaces on a cervical vertebrae or lumbar vertebrae or sacral or coccygeal vertebrae. Here is a lumbar vertebrae characterized by massive body. Okay, there's no facets on the transverse foramina. The spinous process is massive as well, comes straight back, and it's square. All right, the spinous processes on thoracic vertebrae are long and narrow, so it's easy to tell these vertebrae apart from each other. So here's a nice example of a thoracic vertebrae spinous process on a thoracic vertebrae, a nice square process on a lumbar vertebrae. All right, so don't forget to name these things, like the vertebral body, the spinous process, transverse process, the pedicle over here, and then the lamina of a vertebrae. Should be able to draw that out on a piece of paper. All right, the last two divisions are the sacral and coccygeal. Here's the sacrum. It's composed typically of five vertebrae. They're all fused together. You can see the lines of fusion right here. We call these the transverse ridges. They stick out, so there's not a intervertebral disc anymore in this region. This is an anterior view of the sacrum. These are the vertebral bodies right here. So this superior rim of this vertebral body sticks out, so we call this the sacral promontory. This part of the sacrum forms like a wing. It's a big bony plate that sticks off. For muscle attachment, we call this the ala. That's on the anterior surface. Here are some foramina. What's the function of these foramina right here? Passageway for nerves leaving the sacral canal, which is the place where the spinal cord or sacral nerves are found. So here is the sacral canal underneath this bony plate. When you get to this distal region of the sacral canal, we call that the sacral hiatus. And hiatus is just an opening, right, of the sacral canal inferiorly. So these are what we call the anterior sacral foramina because there are nerves that exit anteriorly. But if we flip the sacrum around, here are some more sacral foramina, okay? And you notice that they match up exactly with the anterior sacral foramina, but these holes are here not for nerves to move from anterior to posterior, right, but to move from the sacral canal either anteriorly through the anterior sacral foramina or posteriorly through the posterior sacral foramina. So this is not a passageway through the sacrum, it's just a passageway from the sacral canal to the outside of the sacrum, either anteriorly or posteriorly. That's why these have different names, even though they kind of look like they're the same foramen. All right, then we have the median sacral crest right here for muscle attachment. Here is a joint surface for your hip bones. We call this the auricular surface. And this is kind of, this is an immovable joint, so it's not really a smooth joint. There are a lot of ligaments in this region right here, so it's going to feel kind of rough. All right, I can see the ala once again. And then here is a superior articulating process for articulating with the vertebrae that's right above the sacrum. Who can tell me the name of the vertebrae right above the sacrum? It's lumbar. How many lumbar vertebrae are there? There are five, so this is going to be L5 right in this region right here. Okay, then the coccygeal vertebrae, I see one, two, three, I see four right here, but maybe there are three in some people. Clinically, it's not too significant. Unless you break it, then it hurts like hell. Okay, but it can't be casted, and you'll get over it pretty soon. All right, so that's the sacrum. All right, so we talked about the skull. We talked about the vertebral column, including the sacrum and the coccygeal vertebrae. That pretty much leaves us to talk about the rib cage. Right, or thoracic cage. Let me see what else we got here. Okay, so I see ribs and I see the sternum. Sometimes we call this the breastbone, but that's not proper anatomic terminology. All right, so here is the sternum. The sternum is made out of three bones. The superior one is the manubrium, and it's a flat bone. The next one is the body of the sternum, and then the most inferior part is the xiphoid process. In young people, it's cartilage. In us, it's ossified. It's turned into bone already. And sometimes there's a foramen. There's a sternal foramen in this region as well. Somebody in here has got one. It's not too common, but probably somebody in here has got a hole right here in the sternum. So you got manubrium, body, and xiphoid process. Here is a joint between the manubrium and the sternum. Sometimes we call that the manubriosternal joint. Remember, as long as we put an O between those names of these two bones right here, then everybody knows exactly what you're talking about. And if you were to palpate your sternum right in that location, you know that it's actually sticking out right there. It forms an angle. It puckers out a little bit, and so we call this the sternal angle. The xiphoid process and the joint, the xiphosternal joint right here is kind of a weak joint, so it's pretty easy to break the xiphoid process off. And in us, we said that that's a bone. And a bone fragment is pretty sharp, so that can lacerate organs underneath. So what kind of organs would be in this area right here that the xiphoid process could lacerate if it started to migrate around? The heart, the lungs, all vital organs, right? But the body of the sternum sometimes is used to help somebody whose heart has stopped breathing. We can do chest compressions on somebody whose heart has stopped, and when you do chest compressions, that pressurizes a little blood that's in the heart, which maybe forces some blood to the brain to keep their brain alive until you can get their heart started on their own. Okay, and it's important to do chest compressions, not on the xiphoid process right here, because it can break off and then that can lacerate the heart. And instead of helping somebody, what have you done? You've actually hurt them a little bit, right? Or actually a lot, because the xiphoid process can move into the liver as well, which is in this region, and cause some hemorrhage. So when you do chest compressions, it's always important to find out where the xiphoid process is by palpation and move away from it superiorly so that you do chest compressions on what part of the sternum? the body of the sternum right here. Exactly. Okay, so that's pretty important. In the manubrium, we have the jugular notch. We also have another notch right here. We call this the clavicular notch, because there's a bone called the clavicle that's going to articulate right here. That's a part of the appendicular skeleton, so we're not going to talk about that today. So a clavicle or collarbone is going to come up over this way and over this way from the clavicular notch. Here's a jugular notch. All right, so that leaves us pretty much with the ribs. And here is L1, that's our first lumbar vertebrae. This is not a rib, this is a transverse process. Here's another transverse process sticking out, but here is a rib. So what vertebrae would we call this? What vertebrae is this right here? T12. Yeah, it's the last, the most inferior thoracic vertebrae. And remember, we said that you have to have exactly the same number of vertebrae as you have pairs of ribs. So this individual is absolutely normal. There are 12 pairs of ribs, and you can count each of these vertebrae. There are 12. So this one right here is, what vertebrae is this one? That's T1. And I see the first vertebrae, and there is a piece of costal cartilage that goes from the tip of this rib over to the sternum, as well as rib number 2 and 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Look at 7. Here's a costal cartilage which still goes directly all the way to the sternum, and even number 7 right here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Here's a cartilage that goes all the way to the sternum. So ribs 1 through 7 are what we call true ribs, because they have a costal cartilage that goes directly to the sternum. But if we look at rib number 8, so here's 7, here's rib number 8. It has a costal cartilage, but look where it goes. It stops right here. It goes to the costal cartilage of rib number 7. Right? It doesn't go directly to the sternum. And because of that, we call that a false rib. So ribs 7 through 12 are what we call false ribs. They don't have cartilage that goes directly to the sternum. Some go indirectly to cartilage of the rib above it, but the most inferior two ribs don't have any cartilage at all. Ribs 11 and 12 don't have any costal cartilage. So these are false ribs, but they're also called floating ribs as a result. And they're found pretty much only posteriorly. Right? So ribs 11 and 12 are floating ribs, but they are false ribs as well. Rib number 8, okay, 9, and 10 are not floating ribs, but they are false ribs nonetheless. All right, so that's it for the thoracic cage. Okay, let's look at some detail of a rib. Let's look at this photograph right here. So you're going to have to play around with these in lab to get a sense for what's happening. Well, let's take a look at this picture first. All right, so I see some vertebrae right here. What kind of vertebrae are these? Yeah, these are thoracic vertebrae, right, because it has a rib attached to it. So by definition, here is the shaft of the rib. Here is the costal cartilage. So this cartilage is going directly to the sternum. So what kind of rib is this? It's a true rib, right? Because it's being attached directly to the sternum. So here is the shaft. And if we make a nice transverse section through the shaft of the rib, we notice that there is a little groove right here for a blood vessel that comes around and courses with the rib. All right? This is sometimes really hard to see when you look at a rib, but it's easy to feel with your fingertips. So in lab, I want you to palpate that costal groove. And what side of the rib is this costal groove going to be in? Is it going to be on the medial? Is it going to be on the medial margin of the rib or the lateral margin of this rib? It's going to be medial, right? So that's one way to tell the medial aspect. The bottom, the inferior surface, inferior edge of the rib is going to be pretty sharp. The superior edge of a rib is pretty blunt. So this is one way that you can tell if it's going to be a right or left rib. All right, so let's go posteriorly down the shaft. The rib is going to make a pretty severe bend. We call that the angle of the rib. And then it's going to get to a point to where it articulates with a thoracic vertebrae. So here's the body of a thoracic vertebrae. Here's the transverse process. There is a bump right here called the tubercle of a rib. It's going to articulate with the transverse costal facet on the spinous process of a thoracic vertebrae, right here and right here. Then there's going to be a narrowing. We call that the neck of a rib. And then there's going to be another enlargement on the proximal epiphysis, and we call that the head of the rib. And the head of the rib has a couple articulating surfaces that articulate with the costal facet right here on the vertebral body. Sometimes we call this a demifacet. So, and that's because the head of a rib articulates with actually the body of two vertebrae, the superior one and the inferior one right here. Can you see it articulating with the body here and this region right here? So sometimes we call this a demifacet, a demifacet. And demi just means half of a facet. We put these two demifacets together and you get a facet for articulating with the entirety of the head of this particular rib. Who knows what a demigod is? So here's a demifacet. Here's a demifacet. What's a demigod? Maybe some of you have heard that. A demigod is from Greek mythology. I think it's Greek. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's probably Greek. It is the offspring of what? When a god and a mortal had a love affair and produced some offspring, and so they're half god, half mortal, and so they're called demigods. So half. Demi means half. Here's half of a facet. Here's half of a facet on the vertebral body over here. Okay, so you got two floating ribs, three non-floating ribs, five false ribs all together. All right, so that's pretty much the axial skeleton. Let me see what other nifty pictures are in this area. Okay, so here is a fetal skull. And I can see some sutures that haven't completely ossified in this region right here. So here's a sagittal suture, here's coronal suture, but I see some additional features on this skull. Now remember that the bones of the skull ossify by what kind of process? How many different kinds of ossification do you know? Two. And they are? Endochondrial and intramembranous ossification. And remember, the bones of the skull form by intramembranous ossification. So at one point in time, all of these bones right here were just a membrane. And here is some of that residual membrane. We call this a fontanelle. Here's the anterior fontanelle. Then I see the posterior fontanelle between the parietal bones and occipital bone. Commonly, these are called soft spots because they're not ossified. It's very easy to puncture these spots in a fetus or even a neonate. And so these fontanelles can exist for up to 2 years, 24 months. All right? So the neonate or the newborn can have brain damage if these fontanelles are punctured, but that's not the only other reason. Right? If there is compression or if there's vibration or twisting, right, across this soft spot right here, that can also damage the brain of the newborn baby. So not just puncture wounds. So any kind of violent shaking, right, or compression of these bones right here can damage the fetal brain. And there are four of them. Anterior fontanelle between the frontal and parietal bones, posterior between the occipital and parietal bones, and then near the mastoid process, here's the mastoidal fontanelle, and near the sphenoid bone, here is the sphenoidal fontanelle. And fontanelle can be spelled a couple different ways. So here's a kind of a classical way. F-O-N-T-A-N-E-L-L-E. And sometimes it's spelled N-E-L on the end of the word. Okay, so you can spell it either way that you want. All right, and commonly these are what we call soft spots. We'll have those to look at in lab. Yes. Oh, yeah, that attendance sheet. Thank you for reminding me. Let's get that going right away. Okay, let's look at Let's look at the view inside the cranial vault. And I see three main depressions. I see a depression here, and I see one here, and then I see one back over here. This is what we call the anterior cranial fossa. Here's the middle cranial fossa and the posterior cranial fossa. And what's the function of a fossa once again? It's for holding something. So the anterior cranial fossa is holding the frontal lobes of the brain. And the middle cranial fossa is holding the temporal lobes of the brain. And the posterior cranial fossa here is holding the occipital lobe of the brain. The other thing that I notice are all of the foramina inside the cranial vault. So here is the frontal bone in this region right in the center. That's the ethmoid bone. And the ethmoid bone has this protuberance sticking up superior from it. That's the crista galli. And the crista galli is important because the membrane that surrounds the brain, called the meninges, attaches to the crista galli right here. So the ethmoid bone is pretty important. It keeps your brain from sloshing around inside your head when you turn your head. Okay, this horizontal plate on either side of the crista galli is what we call the cribriform plate. It helps form the anterior cranial fossa. But another thing that I notice within the cribriform plate are all of these foramina right here. And we call that the olfactory foramina. And it's a special sense on our body. The sense of olfaction is the same as the sense of smell. So there are nerves that leave the brain and go down into the nasal cavity because this is anterior. Here is posterior. So the ethmoid bone is also important for the sense of smell because that's how olfactory nerves enter the nasal cavity. All right, some other foramina that we see. Just posterior to the ethmoid bone, we have the sphenoid that moves all the way from the left to the right side of the cranium. Right, it helps make up the middle cranial fossa, and I can see a number of foramina in it. Here is the optic canal, which is the second most anterior sense on your face. Your nose is number one, number two is for vision, right here, optic canal. And if we were to insert a probe into these optic canal, we would see that it would deviate from right to left as you go from anterior to posterior. And the optic canal on the left side would deviate from left to right as it goes posteriorly. And that's because the optic nerve actually crosses over each other. That's going to be an important thing for you to notice when we get to the nervous system. All right, so we got olfactory foramina. And then the optic canal. In the sphenoid bone, then we're going to find three foramina that make a nice line. And these are foramen rotundum, ovale, and spinosum. So rotundum is going to look nice and round. Ovale is going to have a nice oval shape to it. Spinosum is going to be really small. And then just medial to foramen ovale right here is another foramen, foramen lacerum. It's going to be in a deep depression formed by the sphenoid bone. All right, so you got optic canal, rotundum, ovale, spinosum, and lacerum, all part of the sphenoid bone. Another important part of the sphenoid bone is a depression. What do we call a depression? A fossa. So here's a fossa. It's for holding the pituitary gland. And another name for pituitary gland is hypophysis. So that's why they call this the hypophyseal fossa, because it's holding the hypophysis or the pituitary gland. In this location right here. So this is the body of the sphenoid. Deep inside the body of the sphenoid is the sphenoid sinus, which we can't really see on this diagram, but it would be in this location. All right, then posterior to the sphenoid bone is the temporal bone that we can see even laterally. Right, the external acoustic meatus in the temporal bone is right here, which on this part of the illustration would be right about here. So the external acoustic meatus is right about here. So your ear is in this location. But if we look on the inside of the cranial vault, we see the internal acoustic meatus. This passageway is not complete all the way through the temporal bone. It's not what we call patent. This internal acoustic meatus stops right about here. There's a nerve that enters the temporal bone, and the external acoustic meatus, which I see right here, doesn't go all the way through either. It stops right about here. That's a passageway for sound energy to enter the temporal bone. So sound enters the temporal bone, and then there are sensors for sound pressure in this region of the temporal bone. It's a pretty thick part of the temporal bone, and that's called the petrous region of the temporal bone. Petrous region is right between the internal acoustic meatus and the external acoustic meatus, kind of like right on a line right here. All right, posterior to the internal acoustic meatus, there's a big foramen. That's a jugular foramen. And you could probably tell me what moves through the jugular foramen. What's a passageway? It's a passageway for what? A jugular vein. So all the blood returning from your brain back to your heart goes through this little hole right here. Actually, it's a pretty big hole, through the jugular vein. All right, a couple more foramina. This big one is the foramen magnum. That's where the brain leaves the cranium and enters the spinal, the vertebral column. And when it enters the vertebral column, as it passes through the foramen magnum, then we don't call that a part of the brain anymore. We call it the spinal cord. Nonetheless, the spinal cord and the brain, right, make up part of the central nervous system. So spinal cord and brain make up central nervous system. The foramen magnum is the line that separates the two. In the rim of the foramen magnum, we have the hypoglossal canal right here and right here. All right, so this is a pretty important exam figure. Don't forget, another name for hypophysis is the pituitary gland. And let me see if I can find a nice illustration of this pituitary. Oh, this is probably pretty good right here. All right, so here is the sphenoid. And here's the sphenoid sinus. Here's the cella turcica, which is the hypophyseal fossa. The pituitary gland is going to be right here. Sometimes it turns cancerous and it has to be removed. It's right at the base of the brain. And you might think that's really kind of a super dangerous surgery because it requires going through the brain to get to the pituitary. But look at where the pituitary gland is. All right, so here is the oral cavity. Here's the nasal cavity right here. All right, it's just right on the other side of the body of the sphenoid from the nasal cavity. So it's actually very easy to access by just going in the oral cavity, going up to the roof of the nasal cavity, right, and just making some small incisions into the sphenoid bone, and you can find your way to the pituitary pretty quickly as a result. All right, so it's not really brain surgery. Here is the maxilla. The maxilla, along with the palatine bone here, makes the hard palate, the bony roof of the mouth, or the floor of the nasal cavity. So anteriorly is the maxilla, posteriorly is the palatine bone. Can anybody remember what the shape of the palatine bone is? It's kind of L-shaped, and your thumb would be the horizontal plate of the palatine, and your index finger makes the lateral walls of the nasal cavity. So here's the perpendicular plate of the palatine bone. And then this part of the maxilla, sometimes we could call that the horizontal plate, but it has a better name because it's touching the palatine bone. Sorry about that, cursor. Since it's touching the palatine bone right here, right, remember that we name a process on a bone, not by the name of the bone that it's on, but by the name of the bone that it is touching. So this is the palatine process of the maxilla because it's touching the palatine bone. All right, sometimes there's malformations of the hard palate right here. We call that a cleft palate. So there's a cleft or a space between the oral cavity and the nasal cavity. And that's very dangerous for newborn babies because, okay, if there's a passageway, a patent passageway between the oral cavity and nasal cavity, then it's not possible for the infant to develop any suction with the mouth. And if you can't develop suction with the mouth because it's always going to let air in through the nasal cavity right here, what can't an infant do? It can't get nutrition, right? It can't nurse. It can't suckle as a result of that. So that has to be repaired pretty quickly so that the infant can thrive. This fossa right here, notice it doesn't go through all the way between the oral cavity and the nasal cavity. We call that the incisive foramen because these are the incisors, these teeth. Okay, and these are molars back over here. The other thing I notice on this slide are the bones that make up the nasal septum. And they are the ethmoid bone and the, and here's part of the ethmoid bone, and the vomer down in this region right over here. Okay, there are some shells within the nasal cavity. Here's the middle nasal concha, here's the inferior nasal concha, and the superior nasal concha right up over here. So there are three shelves that air condition the air as we breathe in, filters the air of dust particles and bacteria and viruses and fungi and all kinds of things, so that helps protect our lungs from infection. All right, so here's that sphenoid bone once again. There's a bony plate that sticks down inferiorly, laterally, on either side of the body of the sphenoid, and we call this the pterygoid process. Right? There are two pterygoid processes on a sphenoid bone. Here's a sphenoid bone, so here are the pterygoid processes, and here, and you want to remember that because the pterygoid muscles attach to the sphenoid bone as well as the mandible for elevating the mandible, for instance, when you're chewing food. Okay, let me go look at another picture right here. All right, here's an anterior view. Here is the optic canal. You know where it is on the inside. There are a couple elongated foramina in this posterior part of the orbit. We call these fissures, right? So a fissure is an elongated foramen. So here's the superior orbital fissure. Here's the inferior orbital fissure. You can't always see these when you look at the sphenoid bone because they're made up of a number of different bones, part of the maxilla, part of the zygomatic. Okay, so the bones that make up the orbit, frontal bone, here's the orbital plate of the frontal bone. If we look inside the orbit, the zygomatic bone, I can see the orbital plate of the zygomatic bone. Here is the sphenoid, and the greater wing of the sphenoid makes up the orbital plate of the sphenoid. Okay, the lacrimal bone and ethmoid bone make up the orbit. I think that's all I want to show you on that particular diagram. I don't know if this is an exam figure. I got a feeling maybe it is not. Okay, that's an important exam figure. Okay, let's look at some disarticulated bones. We see the temporal bone. And you know this is the temporal bone because you can see the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. What bone is the zygomatic process touching anteriorly, like in this region right here? The zygomatic bone, because that's how we name the zygomatic process. Then the styloid process and mastoid process. There's a little foramen between the styloid process and mastoid process. How would you name this little foramen, which I can't really see? I'd have to tilt the temporal bone up. That's the stylomastoid foramen. Okay, here is the external acoustic meatus. Right on the other side of this external acoustic meatus, on the inside of the temporal bone, which we can't see, what region of the temporal bone is that? That's the petrous region of the temporal bone. Here is the flat region of the temporal bone called the squamous region. Okay, now who can tell me what suture is this right here? That's the squamous suture, right, squamous suture. And then what suture is this right here? Occipital mastoid suture. Okay. Okay, and we see a nice sphenoid bone. Okay, sphenoid sinus, frontal sinus. Maybe I can see some ethmoid sinuses. Here's the crista galli sticking up. Here's a cribriform plate with olfactory foramina in it. Here's a foramen. Anybody know what this foramen is called right here? Mandibular foramen. The mental foramen is going to be on the mental surface of the mandible anteriorly. Then here is the internal acoustic meatus. Here's the petrous region of the temporal bone between the internal acoustic meatus and the external acoustic meatus, which we can't quite see on this diagram. Okay, those of you that have a practicum on Wednesday, you probably want to make sure you look at the histology pictures right here, and also the cranial bones. Where are the cranial bones at? I guess you have to, here, axial skeleton. Okay, look through these bones right here. Like, for instance, what bone is that? Ethmoid. You can see the perpendicular plate. You can see the crista galli, the cribriform plate. Okay, the inferior nasal concha, superior nasal concha. All right, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Oh, it's not 10 after yet. Are you listening to lecture? Okay, cool.
Practicum. Do you know how you showed us those small pieces of bone? Like the bone mark?